wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host. Our producer is Patricia Kohlberg. Today's program is geared toward a couple of celebratory occasions. As you know from all the grocery flyers trying to sell us green cabbage and Irish cheddar, this week holds St. Patrick's Day. Both Patricia and I are wearing green as I speak. More to the point, Joe Clement and Mara Zussman will take us back to Kilkenny at the time of the first of the great bourgeois revolutions, the English, and Oliver Cromwell's conquest of Ireland. Joined by Raisa and Moses, members of the Old Mole Youth Brigade, as the Old Mole Variety Hour builds toward the future, they'll review the 2020 animated film Wolf Walkers. Are the protagonists young women? Or are they really wolves or witches? And what do the wolves stand for? Turning from colonial conquest, wolves, and history to nuclear power, Bill Resnick interviews M.V. Ramana. Nuclear power is again being promoted as a solution to climate change. Bill enlists Ramana to evaluate these claims. Is there a role for nukes in replacing fossil fuels? I mentioned that today's program acknowledges two celebratory occasions. Last Monday, of course, was International Women's Day, originally International Working Women's Day, or International Women's Labor Day. But did you know that this entire month is International Women's History Month? Women's history is a tricky subject, because for most of history, women didn't exist. A more careful phrasing would be that women weren't acknowledged or were barely acknowledged to exist. But Ursula K. Le Guin, marvelous Portland writer who died 2 years ago, wasn't interested in being careful. She developed a performance piece called Introducing Myself, based on the irony of women not being acknowledged historically. In honor of International Women's History Month, and I hope in honor of one of my favorite authors, Ursula Le Guin, and with the double irony of me, not a woman, portraying a woman, who in turn is portraying a man, well, if that sounds confusing, you'll get it once I start. Just imagine it's Ursula speaking, though you're hearing my voice. And when she, that is, I, starts out by saying, I am a man, she's making a gender statement, not referring to the demand for racial dignity of the striking Memphis sanitation workers in 1964, where Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. You remember, they too insisted, I am a man. So, here goes. Introducing myself. I am a man. Now, you may think I've made some kind of silly mistake about gender, or maybe that I'm trying to fool you, because my first name ends in an A, and I own 3 bras, and I've been pregnant 5 times, and other things like that that you might have noticed. Little details. I am a man, and I want you to believe and accept this as a fact, just as I did for many years. You see, when I was growing up at the time of the wars of the Medes and Persians, and when I went to college just after the Hundred Years' War, and when I was bringing up my children during the Korean, Cold, and Vietnam Wars, there were no women. Women are a very recent invention. I predate the invention of women by decades. Well, if you insist on pedantic accuracy, women have been invented several times in widely varying localities, but the inventors just didn't know how to sell the product. Their distribution techniques were rudimentary, and their market research was nil, and so, of course, the concept just didn't get off the ground. Even with a genius behind it, an invention has to find its market. And it seemed like for a long time, the idea of women just didn't make it to the bottom line. Models like the Austin and the Bronte were too complicated, and people just laughed at the suffragette, and the Virginia Woolf was way too far ahead of its time. So when I was born, there actually were only men. People were men. They all had one pronoun, his pronoun. So that's who I am. I am the generic he, as in, if anybody needs an abortion, he will have to go to another state. Or, a writer knows which side his bread is buttered on. That's me, the writer, him. I am a man. Not maybe a first-rate man. I'm perfectly willing to admit that I may be, in fact, a kind of second-rate or imitation man, a pretend-a-him. As a him, I am to a genuine male him, as a microwaved fish stick is to a whole grilled Chinook salmon. I mean, after all, can I inseminate? Can I belong to the Bohemian Club? Can I run General Motors? Theoretically, I can, but you know where theory gets us, not to the top of General Motors. And then, I can't write my name with P in the snow, or it would be awfully laborious if I did. I can't shoot my wife and children and some neighbors and then myself. Oh, to tell you the truth, I can't even drive. I never got my license. I chickened out. I take the bus. That is terrible. I admit it. I am actually a very poor imitation or substitute man. And you could see it when I tried to wear those army surplus clothes with ammunition pockets that were trendy, and I looked like a hen in a pillowcase. I am shaped wrong. People are supposed to be lean. You can't be too thin. Everybody says so. People are supposed to be lean and taut, because that's how men generally are, lean and taut. Or anyhow, that's how a lot of men start out, and some of them even stay that way. And men are people. People are men. That has been well established. And so people, real people, the right kind of people, are lean. But I'm really lousy at being people, because I'm not lean at all, but sort of podgy, with actual fat places. I am untaught. And then people are supposed to be tough. Tough is good. But I've never been tough. I'm sort of soft, and actually sort of tender. Like a good steak, or like Chinook salmon, which isn't lean and tough, but very rich and tender. But then, salmon aren't people. Or anyhow, we have been told that they aren't in recent years. We have been told that there is only one kind of people, and they are men. And I think it is very important that we all believe that. It certainly is important to the men. What it comes down to, I guess, is that I am just not manly, like Ernest Hemingway was manly. The beard and the guns and the wives and the little short sentences. I do try. I have this sort of beardoid thing that keeps trying to grow 9 or 10 hairs on my chin, sometimes even more. But what do I do with the hairs? I tweak them out. Would a man do that? Men don't tweak. Men shave. Anyhow, white men shave, being hairy. And I have even less choice about being white or not than I do about being a man or not. I am white whether I like being white or not. The doctors can do nothing for me. But I do my best not to be white, I guess, under the circumstances, since I don't shave. I tweak. But it doesn't mean anything, because I don't really have a real beard that amounts to anything. And I don't have a gun. And I don't have even one wife, and my sentences tend to go on and on and on with all this syntax in them. Ernest Hemingway would have died rather than have syntax. Or semicolons. I use a whole lot of half-assed semicolons. There was one of them, just now. And another thing, Ernest Hemingway would have died rather than get old. And he did. He shot himself. A short sentence. Anything rather than a long sentence. A life sentence. Death sentences are short and very, very manly. Life sentences aren't. They go on and on, all full of syntax and qualifying clauses and confusing references and getting old. And that brings up the real proof of what a mess I have made of being a man. I am not even young. Just about the time they finally started inventing women, I started getting old, and I went right on doing it, shamelessly. I have allowed myself to get old and haven't done one single thing about it, with a gun or anything. What I mean is, if I had any real self-respect, wouldn't I at least have had a facelift or some liposuction? Although, liposuction sounds to me like what they do a lot of on TV when they are young or youngish, though not when they are old, and when one of them is a man and the other a woman, though not under any other circumstances. What they do is, this young or youngish man and woman take hold of each other and slide their hands around on each other, and then they perform liposuction. You are supposed to watch them while they do it. They move their heads around and flatten out their mouth and nose on the other person's mouth and nose, and open their mouths in different ways, and you are supposed to feel sort of hot or wet or something as you watch. What I feel is like I'm watching two people doing liposuction. And this is why they finally invented women? Surely not. As a matter of fact, I think sex is even more boring as a spectator sport than all the other spectator sports, even baseball. If I am required to watch a sport instead of doing it, I'll take show jumping. The horses are really good looking. The people who ride them are mostly these sort of Nazis, but like all Nazis, they are only as powerful and successful as the horse they are riding. And it is, after all, the horse who decides whether to jump that five-barred gate or stop short and let the Nazi fall off over its neck. Only, usually the horse doesn't remember it has the option. Horses aren't awfully bright. But in any case, show jumping and sex have a good deal in common, though you can usually only get show jumping on American TV if you can pick up a Canadian channel, which is not true of sex. Given the option, though I often forget that I have an option, I certainly would watch show jumping and do sex, never the other way around. But I'm too old now for show jumping, and as for sex, who knows? I do. You don't. Of course, golden oldies are supposed to jump from bed to bed these days, just like horses jumping the five-barred gates, bounce, bounce, bounce. But a good deal of this super sex at 70 business seems to be theory again, like the woman CEO of General Motors. Theory is invented mostly to reassure people in their 40s, that is, men, who are worried. That is why we had Karl Marx and why we still have economists, though we seem to have lost Karl Marx. As such, theory is dandy. As for practice, or praxis, as the Marxists used to call it, apparently because they liked X's, you wait till you are 60 or 70, and then you can tell me about your sexual practice, or praxis, if you want to, though I make no promises that I will listen. And if I do listen, I will probably be extremely bored and start looking for some show jumping on the TV. In any case, you are not going to hear anything from me about my sexual practice or praxis then, now, or ever. But all that aside, here I am, old. When I wrote this, I was 60 years old, a 60-year-old smiling public man, as Yeats said. But then he was a man. And now I am over 70, and it's all my own fault. I get born before they invent women, and I live all these decades trying so hard to be a good man that I forget all about staying young, and so I didn't. And my tenses get all mixed up. I just am young, and then all of a sudden I was 60, and maybe 80. And what next? Not a whole lot. I keep thinking there must have been something that a real man could have done about it, something short of guns, but more effective than oil of Olay. But I failed. I did nothing. I absolutely failed to stay young. And then I look back on all my strenuous efforts, because I really did try. I tried hard to be a man, to be a good man, and I see how I failed at that. I am at best a bad man, an imitation, phony, second-rate him with a 10-hair beard and semicolons. And I wonder, what was the use? Sometimes I think I might just as well give the whole thing up. Sometimes I think I might just as well exercise my option, stop short in front of the 5-barred gate, and let the Nazi fall off onto his head. If I'm no good at pretending to be a man, and no good at being young, I might just as well start pretending that I am an old woman. I'm not sure that anybody has invented old women yet, but it might be worth trying. That was an Ursula Le Guin performance piece, Introducing Myself, very slightly adapted by me. You can find it online or in her collection, The Wave in the Mind. I presented that piece as part of International Women's History Month. To further that theme, here's a little bit of Anne Feeney playing Union Maids. Anne Feeney died just recently and been trying to play as much of her music as we can on The Old Mole. So again, Anne Feeney and Union Maids.
There once was a union maid who never was afraid. All the goons and the kings and the company pinks and the deputy sheriffs who made the raid. She went to the union hall when meeting it was called. And when those company goons came round, she always stood her ground. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking with the union. I'm sticking with the union. I'm sticking with the union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking with the union. This union maid was wise.
And now Joe Clement and Mara Zussman review the animated adventure film Wolf Walkers.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, joined today by my matey, Mara Zussman, to review Wolf Walkers. Directed by Tom Moore and Ross Stewart, Wolf Walkers is a 2020 animated fantasy adventure film set in Kilkenny, Ireland in 1650. It's the third and final installment in their critically acclaimed, hand-drawn Irish folklore trilogy, preceded by The Secret of Kells in 2009 and Song of the Sea in 2014. In Wolfwalkers, Robin Goodfellow, voiced by Honor Nevesy, is an English girl of about 10 who comes to the fortified town with her father, Bill Goodfellow, voiced by Sean Bean, who's there to serve as a hunter for Lord Protector Oliver Cromwell, voiced by Simon McBurney, in his campaign to reconquer Ireland. Specifically, Goodfellow was there to hunt wolves, who attack and menace colonizer and colonized alike where the forest surrounding the city is increasingly cleared for settlement, farming, and timber. Robin is supposed to stay in the city when her father hunts, but she follows him out anyway, accompanied by her pet falcon Merlin. When they encounter the wolves, and Robin misses one with her crossbow, the arrow hits Merlin, who's rescued by a mysterious red-headed girl that takes him back to the forest. Robin is told again by her father, and now the Lord Protector, to go back to the town, but escapes when she creates a diversion and goes looking for Merlin. Back in the forest, she encounters a strange wolf whose friendly attention scares her so much she steps in a trap. The wolf tries to help Robin escape the trap and is successful, but bites her accidentally. She follows the wolf back to its den where she witnesses it turn into a spirit that merges with the girl she saw before, sleeping in the den. This is Mev, voiced by Ava Whitaker, and she's a wolf walker. A girl when awake and a wolf when the girl sleeps. She reveals that her sleeping mammy, voiced by Maria Doyle Kennedy, had been planning to leave the forest, but hasn't returned in a long time while away in wolf form. Robin is impressed with the friendliness and magic of the wolf walker Mev, who heals her bite, and thinks that she can convince her father that the campaign against the wolves can be called off since they're leaving. When she gets back to the city, though, she discovers the Lord Protector plans to burn down the whole forest to exterminate the wolves and is prevented from returning to tell Mev. Well, thanks for joining me, Mara, to review this film.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into what's going on in this movie, do you want to just say a little bit about why we ended up watching it, what drew us to it?
Sure. I heard that Tom Moore put out another movie, and we really loved watching Secret of Kells and Song of the Sea. And partly I sought out those movies because my daughter has some Irish ancestry, and I felt like it was important for her to have some connection to it and have some, you know, just stories. And yeah, so this film, we were really excited to watch it with our kids. There's so much going on in it, so there was a lot to draw from. Do you want to say why you wanted to talk about it for St. Patrick's Day?
I think it's a welcome change of pace from the way that St. Patrick's Day is observed and celebrated in the United States, a historical colonizer. And in this movie, the Irish are so far removed from the possibility of being the colonizer, of having been folded into whiteness, that there is something different about what it's saying about the history of Irish oppression, because it's been brought up a lot, especially in the age of the internet, how there were Irish slaves. And this is often brought up in a way that is meant to minimize the reality of racial oppression, of white supremacy, of whiteness. And it's hard to watch that movie and make this kind of argument, because the kind of colonial domination that the film is showing us is typical of today's heteropatriarchal, white supremacist, neocolonialist, capitalist world order. And, you know, there's these other themes that aren't specifically Irish that I think are the connection to the land, the question of what is happening to the land as people take it over, convert it to property, clear it out, turn it into what suits them. These are themes that are literally shaping the world and have been for the 400 or 500 years that capitalism has been around. And this film is set basically kind of at the early stages of that process.
Yeah, and I think another reason why we wanted to talk about it was just because I think as white folks who are trying to be anti-racist, and I think a big piece of that journey is, as white anti-racists, we know that it's important to have a connection to our ancestors, because that's something that assimilating into whiteness has taken away from us. You know, just kind of looking back at the history and what was happening during this time in Europe and England and Ireland, around the enclosures and just around the loss of culture and identity, you know, ultimately for the project of capitalism. And then how all of that got exported to the New World. So that, anyway, there's a lot going on in this movie.
So yeah, it's set in 1650, which is in the middle of what was called the Third English Civil War. It's a year after Parliament votes to execute King Charles I for being treasonous and a traitor to the people. And it is the beginning of this period when Oliver Cromwell seizes power with basically a armed party, the New Model Army, and stages a kind of military coup. Oliver Cromwell is this statesman and guy born into the middle gentry in 17th century England, and he is a Puritan, and he comes to Ireland to rid it of Catholics and to civilize it, in his words as they're portrayed in the film. And this was one of the most brutal periods in Irish history. There are works of art today that draw on Cromwell as a figure of fascism, of this super totalitarian religious kind of authoritarian, who was also in some ways a revolutionary. He was bucking the old order of the aristocracy. But in Ireland, he, you know, waged a campaign of genocide against Catholics, but by extension, because of the hegemony of Catholicism in Ireland, it really meant an attack on the Irish people themselves. And that is looked at in this film through the lens of the wolves. The wolves are a wild animal, but they are also symbolic of the wild upstarts that the Irish seem to be to the English colonizers. And they're either taming them, which is one of the promises made by the Lord Protector character in this film, or just eliminating them, is part of a project of civilizing, of making the world better in their eyes.
Right, and it's, you know, the wolf walkers as part wolf, part witch. And so the witch hunts that were prevalent during this time and before and after, kind of, you know, there's like a nod to that as well. And yeah, I mean, Maeve is just such an incredible character. I just, you know, she is wild. She turns into a wolf, and, you know, she just but she's like so joyful and protective, and really befriends this this other little girl, Robin, who is trying to. She's rebellious in her own way. She totally defies what the puritanical order, you know, prescribes for her, which is just to like stay home or to work in a scullery doing household chores. And she wants to hunt, be a hunter like her father, and she wants to be free and wild. And so she just finds this kindred, this kinship with Maeve. And ultimately kind of becomes the thing that she sets out to hunt, like the hunted, the hunter becomes the hunted, which is just a beautifully, you know, beautiful twist in the movie.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking today with Mara Zussman about the 2020 fantasy adventure animated film Wolfwalkers. So, spoiler alert, we're going to talk a bit about how the film ends, because though this film is based around a lot of history, it takes a lot of liberties, and one of those is that this Lord Protector Oliver Cromwell figure ends up dying in the story, in the forest, and that is not how the real Oliver Cromwell died. He died in 1658 after his campaign in Ireland. He died of what's been described as natural causes. And so what do you like about how this film ends, and what is the benefit maybe for it not being the exact history?
I'm no like Irish history expert or anything, but Cromwell definitely, you know, has a bad reputation amongst the Irish, part of a legacy of extreme brutality against the people and the land. And so imagining him perishing in his attempt at destroying the forest and these spiritual beings, the Wolfwalkers, feels kind of, you know, righteous. And what's interesting is like, so I also wanted to talk about just kind of from a psychological perspective a little bit about Robin's father. His name's Bill Goodfellow. He's kind of like a common man. You can see that he has this really secure kind of attachment to Robin. They both love each other. But Robin's become a wolf walker at this point, and he's afraid, and he talks about that. Like, you know, the reason why he continues to insist that Robin stay home and that she has to work, and like work is prayer, you know, is because ultimately we find out that he's afraid of being separated from her, of not being able to protect her. And in this final scene, or one of the final scenes, he gets bit as well. And you see him slowly realize that he's transforming into a wolf walker. And it's actually the way in which he stays attached and connected to Robin and how they stay a family. He has to like cross over to the magical side to like stay connected to her. And once the Lord Protector gets bit and realizes that he's about to transform as well, he actually takes his life because of his allegiance to his God and the puritanical values that he holds. So I thought that was just kind of an interesting juxtaposition.
And the two families in this kind of classic structure become one in the end. You have a mother and a daughter and a father and a daughter. Robin's mother is not around, and it's not implied that she is still alive. And so when everyone is freed in the end, and everyone is, as Robin puts it, part of the same pack, they go off into the sunset, you know, clearly having kind of formed a new family unit. And in that, like, integrating the two peoples and being whole, finding some kind of intactness despite the kind of severed cultures and ways of life that colonization process brought.
Right. It's like there's that hopefulness that they can live another day. And even though they have to flee the forest and, like, the magical oak tree that gets cut down at the end, which was kind of this, like, sad part. What are some other things that you liked about the movie or that you wanted to share?
Well, just kind of to nerd out a bit on the name Robin Goodfellow, that is this kind of puckish figure in English folklore who is mentioned famously in A Midnight Summer's Dream by William Shakespeare, writing about 50 years earlier. And it's also a name that Karl Marx associates with his figure of the old mole, which is interesting because it's like Robin's pagan roots are realizing themselves in light of this puckish person from Ireland who is clearly connected to their earth-based spirituality.
And that reminds me, I really wanted to bring in Sylvia Federici's book, Caliban and the Witch. Federici is a Marxist feminist historian and in this book tragically writes of the enclosures and what happened to the commons. And, you know, this film, and of course, the witch hunts, and this film definitely touches on some of that. So the commons was a space that created like a patchwork for just commoners, villagers to subsist on. But it was more than that. It was a gathering space where people like practiced culture, where people came together to celebrate natural cycles, where there was a connection to land and the commons. And so the erasure of the commons, and then again, the significance of the witch hunts, which definitely the film, you know, ties in there, to create an underclass of subjugated women who would end up being responsible for the unpaid domestic reproductive labor necessary to create the conditions for wage labor and for industrial capitalism. You know, I think in recent years, there's really been a resurgence of interest in witchcraft, and you see it on Instagram all the time. And so I think that's what people are going to really find really appealing in this film is witchy pagan iconography and the magic in it. And what was inspiring when I read Caliban and the Witch was really understanding how the witches, you know, the reason why they were so threatening to the dominant class at the time were because they were rebelling against the enclosures. And so my hope for folks excited about this movie or just excited about witchcraft in general is finding inspiration from the history, but also realizing that through this like intimate, deep connection to the land and a spiritual connection that creates a motivation to really radically change how we live, you know, like the consumerism and just the like constant growth and everything that's associated with like the destruction of the planet, basically.
Yeah, going back to kind of some of Bill Goodfellow's psychology and really the psychology of this totalitarian and maybe other totalitarian societies is just how he's confronted by Robin later in the film for doing exactly what he's trying to prevent from happening to her. He says that, you know, I hope that one day, you know, you're not in a cage. And she, you know, pushes him off of him and says, what are you talking about? I am in a cage. I'm in a cage because of all of these things that you tell me to do out of fear. And it kind of starts to dawn on him that this is kind of the root of the power over him that he fears.
And so, yeah, getting back to kind of what we talked about earlier, you know, we do feel like it's important to remember that at one point we experienced colonization and genocide and loss of culture, loss of a connection to the land. And I think that through those stories, those histories, and being able to identify with those ancestors, we as white folks anyway, can truly recognize all that we've lost because of whiteness. And so will, you know, hopefully motivate us to keep fighting for, you know, for the liberation of all people.
I think rather than showing us what we have lost, it shows us this fear that we have lost everything to the social and material connections we have to the land and our more reciprocal and convivial relations with each other. But what's appealing about the film is that I think it's short-circuiting that fear that we have lost our humanity. We are given the opportunity to examine how the fear of loss itself drives the colonial capitalist project as a self-fulfilling prophecy, and how not to let the fear of loss trap us in our complicity with these systems of domination and extraction and genocide. That was ultimately what changed in the Bill Goodfellow character. And ironically, Robin Goodfellow is fearless. Her father has to tell her what to be afraid of. And she's much more in touch with her humanity, which is the source of her fearlessness. And it's also what makes her so receptive to the seemingly animal otherness of Meth's character and the earth-based spiritual connection.
And before we wrap up this conversation, after all, this is a children's movie. Just to get another perspective, my daughter has agreed to say a few things about her impressions.
So, Raisa, you're 10 years old, about the same age as Robin and Maeve, the two main characters in the movie. Tell us, what did you think about Wolfwalkers?
Honestly, overall, I think it was a very good movie. It was sort of dramatic, but not in like a really bad way.
Yeah, did you have like a favorite part?
I think it's probably when they did that scene where they played the song Running with the Wolves. That was just a really fun scene where Robin had just discovered that she was a wolf walker. And I definitely enjoyed, like, after the movie, just watching that scene over and over again.
And Risa, do you have a favorite character?
Probably Maeve. I really like how she, like, approached Robin becoming a wolf walker. And I think she's just, like, a very good character.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us in this discussion.
So we have our other child, Moses, on to share a few thoughts they had about Wolfwalkers. Moses, what did you think about Wolfwalkers?
I like when all the person turn into wolves.
Thanks, Moses. I've been talking with my matey Mara Zussman and our children Raisa and Moses, talking about the 2020 fantasy animated Irish folklore film Wolfwalkers. It's available through Apple TV, which you can get a free trial subscription to just to watch this movie. Keep an eye out. I'm sure that it'll show up at the library once we are ordering materials again. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this is Joe Clement.
Here at the Old Mole, we too are running with the wolves. That was Joe Clement, Mara Zussman, Raisa, and Moses. The snippet of music was from the film's soundtrack. Next, on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks with M.V. Ramana, an expert on nuclear power generation.
Hello, Ramana. Welcome to KABU here in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you, Bill.
Ramana is an expert among experts on the nuclear industries, both weaponry and electricity generation. He's written many, many articles and testified around the world, written several books. We will discuss how nuclear power is again rising from the dead, seeking to become the primary replacement for fossil fuels. And nuclear plants have gained many rich and influential supporters, including Bill Gates. Indeed, also, most corporate elites are now coming to support the technological miracle, technological innovation, as the way to deal with climate change that leaves them still in control of society and running their industries and maintaining the capitalist system. So, Ramana, tell us about the perils of nuclear power and the latest very serious pitch by Bill Gates and the nuclear industry, in fact, much of the corporate elite, pitching for huge federal subsidies, huge as a...
An understatement, yes. That's a great question to start with, and I will begin by noting the oddity of people even thinking about nuclear energy as an environmentally friendly source of power. For anybody who has seen what has happened in so many parts of the world, like Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, and from all the big anti-nuclear movements galvanizing against nuclear waste disposal and so on, starting from the 1970s, it should be a big surprise. You know, the problems with nuclear power are quite well known. There's the problem of accidents. We are speaking on the eve of the 10th anniversary of the accidents at Fukushima Daiichi in Japan, which started on 11th March of 2011. And for people who are older, they may also remember what happened in Chernobyl. So the risk of catastrophic accidents is something that is inherent to nuclear power and occurs because you are dealing with a very complex technological system that is filled with hazardous materials like radioactive fission products and so on, which are interacting with each other and operating at high temperatures and pressures, all of which make for the possibility of accidents. The second problem with nuclear power that is should be well known is the fact that as a byproduct of the fission reactions that produce the energy in a nuclear power plant, these reactions also produce what are called fission products, which are radioactive materials, which have extremely long half-lives. In other words, they are hazardous to human beings till they decay into something stable, and that can take of the order of tens of thousands of years to hundreds of thousands of years. So for this unprecedented long period of time, we have to try to steward this and make sure that people are not going to come into contact with it. And there's almost no way we can confidently be assured that these can be kept away from human beings. And this has been a second problem. The last problem with nuclear power is the other thing you alluded to, which is the linkage between the ability to generate nuclear energy and the production of materials like plutonium and highly enriched uranium that can be used to make nuclear weapons. And that connection is something that goes back all the way to the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The technologies that were developed, the materials for those bombs, are exactly the technologies that have been modified to also generate nuclear energy. So these three problems are, I think, inherent to nuclear power, and there is nothing you can do to sort of rid them of those connections.
Yeah, and you will point out in some of your articles, it's also vastly expensive. They're always underestimating the cost and the
exactly.
time it takes, especially with the right. new designs that are even more dangerous than the old designs. They claim, of course, they're safer.
These problems with nuclear energy are well known, and the fact that nuclear energy is being reconsidered today has to do with the problem that you mentioned, which is the current ruling class's inability to deal with the climate crisis. And the reason they find it impossible to deal with it is because they don't want to let go of the current social, economic, and political means that have allowed them to profit and become the richer class here and being able to dominate over so many other people. And as long as they are not willing to forego this sort of underlying capitalist desire for continued economic growth and profits, they will always be looking for some kind of a technological fix. And nuclear energy fits into that very well because it uses very similar sort of systems as the fossil fuel plants that currently generate the bulk of the electricity around the world. And so in that sense, some of the elites see this as a way to continue with life as usual, but just replace coal plants with nuclear plants or gas plants with nuclear plants.
The nuclear power industry has a lot of allies. As Ramana just discussed, most of the capitalist class is supporting a technical fix to climate change, that is a technical innovation. These smartest boys in the world who actually know very, very little except how to organize technology to make vast amounts of money, they're now pushing nuclear energy, and my sense is also the investor-owned utilities are pushing not so much for nuclear energy, but for the big grid, the continent-spanning huge grid that the investor-owned utilities need. Well, I'm going to tell us about that push now in the Biden administration. They're influencing the administration, in fact, taking posts in it.
Yeah, let's talk about Gates, because I think he is actually quite emblematic of so many things that are happening. So Bill Gates, as you know, has sort of been on the talk radio, talk TV circuit, pushing his new book, where he argues essentially that what we need to do to deal with climate change is innovate. You know, one should mention the surprising fact that people like Bill Gates, the loudest voices for promoting this innovation idea, are the ones that have made the most money doing this innovation thing in the past, right? And so it's no surprise that they should be promoting, quote-unquote, innovation, technological innovation. But I think what is more interesting about Bill Gates' approach is that he has been investing in a company called TerraPower that is trying to develop some nuclear power plants. We don't know exactly how much he's invested, but I would guess that he's probably invested a few million dollars, maybe $20 million, I don't know exactly, but something of that order of magnitude. And then what he does is go down to Washington, D.C. or to Beijing or something and say, you governments, you ought to be investing in this. And the reason he has to do that is because it costs roughly of the order of $1 to $2 billion to move one of these paper designs, like what they have come up with at TerraPower, into something that can actually be constructed, right? It requires a lot of engineering work, a lot of testing before you can go ahead and confidently build one of these. And these companies are not willing to invest that kind of money. What they are willing to do, this investor, is basically give a small amount of pocket change so that you can hire a bunch of scientists and engineers and some PR people and some marketing people and then produce a bunch of nice-looking PowerPoint slides that can be flashed around the world. They ultimately want the public to be investing in it, right? So the idea is very similar to how a lot of so-called innovation happens in today's neoliberal capitalist economy, which is that you try to privatize any profit that you get, but you socialize all the costs and the risks. And that's the general philosophy under which this is happening. And now you ask me about how utilities are considering building nuclear power plants, and you can look at where nuclear power plants are being built and where they're not being built. So in the United States, for the bulk of the country, the electricity market is liberalized, which means that basically electricity is bought and sold like any other commodity on a market. And this happened in the 1990s. Prior to that, the way it was done was that there would be some kind of a state body, a public utilities commission or something, that would determine that this particular region required a new plant. It could be a big hydroelectric dam, it could be a windmill, whatever it is. And then they would say, this is something which we are going to be requiring in a few years, therefore we are going to authorize construction of this, and the customer base of that particular electric utility will be paying for the costs eventually. That's a practice that is still followed in some states in the U.S., for example, in the states of Georgia and South Carolina, which were the only two states to have tried to build nuclear plants in this century. And in those states, essentially, the construction was propelled by the state legislatures allowing these utilities to charge customers even before they actually built the plant and started generating electricity. As a result, people in South Carolina are paying billions of dollars towards a plant that was actually ultimately canceled. So, in effect, the utility spent about $9 billion to dig a deep hole, essentially. So, and the only reason they're able to do these kinds of things is because ultimately it's the taxpayer and the ratepayers who are going to pay for all of this. So the talk about all this innovation and, you know, the free market and so on and so forth, it's really not free. It's actually common people who are paying these costs and bearing the risks.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole interviewing Ramana. We just discussed the nuclear power industry's very serious and hopefully last gasp efforts to become the primary provider of electric power in this country, indeed around the world. We discussed the great perils of nuclear energy, as well as the preference, the very strong preference of the capitalist elite to fund nuclear energy as a way of dealing with climate change. They want to maintain their system. Nuclear power advocates claim that they, in fact, will produce enough energy quickly and inexpensively with our new designs to make sure that really the United States does not have to change its production system or build a culture of energy conservation and use reduction. Ramana, one of the reasons that nuclear energy has been defeated in the past is that there is a great popular opposition backed up by analyses of nuclear power such as yours, and of course knowledge, as you pointed out, of the great nuclear plant disasters. I think it's a certainty is that the strong public opposition will also be necessary this time around. It has to intensify and take powerful political position right now. It's sort of well known in professional circles, but not by the public. We've been giving several billion dollars a year to the three nuclear power industry just to keep them alive. And, of course, the military wants that also because, as you pointed out, it's linked to the nuclear weapons development system and gives them a lot of research support. Ramana, tell us about the Biden administration and the Biden energy plans and the possibilities of, in fact, resisting the very strong and powerful demands by the industry.
Yeah. So there's good news and bad news there. The good news is that I think everybody realizes that nuclear power plants are very expensive to construct. So the actual sets of plans to construct them, one can count on the fingers of one hand in the United States. And I don't think that is likely to change before the Biden administration's term is up. We're not going to see a dramatic increase in plans to construct anytime in the next 4 years or 8 years for that matter. The bad news is that the Biden administration has taken essentially a we're not going to rule out anything, we want to make friends with everybody kind of approach. There's a little bit of money there for electric vehicles, there is money for nuclear power, there is money for renewables, there's money for batteries, there's money for hydrogen, you know, you name it, they sort of want to do it. And it goes back to the larger question that we were talking about, which is the fact that they would like to see this problem be solved by some kind of a technological miracle, because they don't want to make any strong sort of political or social changes. Their only way of trying to deal with this is to go into all possible technologies and try to win over different sections of the elite for their project. I think that's the way to sort of think about what the Biden administration is doing.
Biden, in running for president, set up groups to develop a climate action plan. And they had to include, therefore, the Sanders, Ocasio, some radical people. And I think that led to his infrastructure plan. But those are all sort of awaiting future action, and it would be future action by the Congress, who is quite conservative. It seems to me that it's the appropriation process. It's going to be the writing of those infrastructure plans, which will very likely not get through, regardless of what Biden thinks, or even some of his advisors, unless they satisfy these various interests in Congress. All sorts of interests are there. My sense is that unless the American people really rise up in opposition, the final plan on appropriations is going to be heavily weighted towards this innovation stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, innovation by itself is not a good thing or a bad thing. It really depends on what you're innovating and why you're innovating and what the aim of that innovation is. I think the biggest challenge we should be thinking about is that as a country, as a civilization, we are well beyond the ecological limits that our planet can bear with. And despite what people like Elon Musk say, unfortunately, this is the only planet we have. And so if you're trying to, quote-unquote, innovate to figure out how we're going to live more simply with using less resources, the idea that you can innovate in a way as to maintain the current economic model of continued growth is not going to work. Point two, you're absolutely right about talking about the importance of social and political movements on the ground to be able to challenge these things. And I think the Green New Deal, in a way, is a very interesting idea, an innovative idea to use the same term, by which you're trying to solve multiple problems, or at least address multiple problems. Climate change is not seen as completely divorced from all of the social and political hierarchies that people are dealing with. The fact that, you know, people of color, or women, and all kinds of disadvantaged groups are not having a great time in this current world is something that the Green New Deal seeks to address. You cannot expect to have support for a transition away from fossil fuels until you deal with the problems of the unemployment that is going to result from laying off miners and coal plant workers and so on. All those different issues have to be addressed if you are going to have any kind of popular support, right? So just trying to have a social movement purely focused on either stopping nuclear power plants or dealing with climate change is going to be inadequate. Ironically, in a way, the bigger the problem is, perhaps the greater the interest is going to be in terms of a social movement.
We're going to have to end, Ramana. So very soon, we'll have to discuss the alternative to nuclear power. That is the system that actually has a chance to contain climate change and save the planet. That system is locally produced sun and wind energy that can be democratically run, and I mean authentic participatory democracy. It could create also a culture of energy conservation and use reduction. Ramana, thanks so much for talking to us, and we'll do it again.
Thank you so much, Bill. It was a pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to talking again.
So long.
And that is today's program on the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is Norm Diamond. I had a lot of fun with today's program. The performance piece from Ursula Le Guin, again, one of my favorite authors. Ursula died just a couple of years ago. She's still very much a presence in our larger community. She was so much a contributor towards. We did Introducing Myself as a performance piece. I want to thank my producer today, Patricia Kohlberg, Denise Morris of the Old Mole Variety Hour for her editing, the staff and board of the radio station, KBOO, for keeping KBOO going. And then, thanks to everyone who participated in today's program, Joe Clement and Mara Zussman, a wonderful piece on wolf walkers, where they managed to integrate two little ones, Moses and Resa. Thanks to them as well. And then to Bill Resnick and his guest, M.V. Ramana. Again, this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're going to go out with a little bit more of Anne Feeney in honor of International Women's History Month. Again, this is Anne Feeney and her performance of Union Maids.
This union maid was wise to the tricks the company spies. She couldn't be fooled by the company stool. She'd always organize the guys. She always got her way when she struck for higher pay. She'd show her card to the National Guard, and this is what she'd say: "Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking with the union. I'm sticking with the union. I'm sticking with the union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking with the union.